is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
You know, I figured, Matt, we'd actually just cut to the chase here.
Yeah. I want to mention to all the listeners that I really like how we still use a record player to cue the intro
when we're
coming back.
Of course, my friend. And that way, when we need to stop the intro on a dime, we hit a button and it winds down. And here, as we're winding down, you know, I should mention to people, we had some weird stuff happening. Matt, we've actually traveled forward in time now that we know that we made it through what we went through, and we're here to tell people about what they're about to hear on the show tonight.
That's right.
What you're about to hear is something of a strange experiment in podcasting. As we went about the live show, we made a fatal error, didn't we, Matt?
We sure did.
And now I'm going to tell you, the problem is you never open your show talking about ghosts. Our studio became haunted. We skipped over the news. We just went right into ghost stories, and then we went into superstitions in the second hour for what portion of the second hour we were able to be live. But we actually lost our connection with the network. The recording module shut down, and we even at one point lost power to half the bunker. Now, we call this Hadle's chewing on the wires. Maybe. Then again, what it looked like from here inside the bunker was more like a scene from Poltergeist. So we'll say no more for now, but instead we're going to let you hear this reconstructure that we have made of this week's edition of the Grahamian Report, and we'll title this episode, in retrospect, Haunted by Hadles in the Hollow Earth. Stand by. Some conversations are to be sacred. Keep them that way, Matthew.
Yeah.
Habo.
Check two.
Habo.
Habo. Check.
Habo.
Talking. Mikey, you there?
Hello, Habo. Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me? Oh, for
check in.
Hang on, Hobbs. You can't hear me, so it's not going to matter how much I talk.
Says we got a fast connection, but I can't hear you.
I know you can't. Yeah, you'll be able to in a second.
Check two.
Watch this. 2-3-2-2-1-2-3-2-2-3-2-2-2-2. Save, save, save. 1-2-3. Save, save, save. Hob, 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 hobs.
2-2.
I know you hear me now.
I can't hear you. Yes, I can.
How do we sound now?
Excellent.
There we go. Okay, well, that didn't seem to help for some reason. I wonder what was going on.
Check two.
Data packets. Uh-oh. Hold on. Did you have a phaser effect or something on? Man!
The connection speed between you and Micah is fast. Yeah. 2-2-2-2. Check 1-2. Two.
Boy, we're going to be starting here like really soon, so we better be able to have this thing lock solid, ready.
Live alternative talk radio.
All right, gentlemen, here we go. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, you're live.
Geronimo! You like that?
Is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Locked and loaded from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, I am Micah Hanks. You've locked into the Grahamian Report. Glad to be broadcasting with you every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe on the internet via KGRARadio.com. Our journey begins, my friends. Tonight, in addition to news, looking at things happening out there, how that relates to what's going on down here on planet Earth, and various other sundry things, we're going to be looking at the roots of superstition and, more importantly, traditions around the world that keep unusual beliefs. How does that affect us in the everyday? We may be more superstitious than we even realize. That's an important thing to recognize. Joining me in studio, as always, our Graylian Reverend, Mr. Matthew Oakley, my co-host. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Just happy to be here once again in the comforting darkness of the hollow earth.
Comforting darkness indeed, and we are happy to be your comfort, your light in the darkness. Wherever there is despair, we will be your hope, at least as it relates to the kinds of things that we discuss every week as we come together around the ceremonial fire of our minds, the candle in the darkness that illuminates truth. Also joining us live from Master Control in Fort Smith, Arkansas, my good friend, my compadre, Mr. Ace Habo Hobbs. How are you, Race?
I'm wonderful, Micah. Doing fabulous. Ready to get the week started with the Graylian Report. Just sitting down here at the console with a nice, fresh cup of Foster Hobbs coffee with hazelnut creamer. I'm good to go.
Well, you know, here this whole time, I thought you'd be drinking a Jug O' Green.
We have had many of those prior and during the Graylian Report over the years, for sure.
We certainly have. I'm not drinking from a Jug O' Green, but I hold in my hand the Green Flash glass, which is about half full of Guinness. It's one of those nights. I'm not doing coffee or tea tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to go ahead and get right to the goods. And right. Don't get much better than Guinness, does it, Matt?
Absolutely not. I can't wait to get home and have one for myself. I do like what Hobbs said, that the week apparently starts with the Graylian Report. All of us got up at, you know, however early this morning, and yet we've done nothing this week until this started.
You're right. Yeah, I'm glad to be able to engage in a weekly ceremony of kicking off my work week with all of you out there, the Graylian Report. That is true indeed. I had a great day. I've been, working on a new book project that I can't say a whole lot about. I've been working on some articles. I've been working on a little podcasting behind the scenes for the Graylian X crew over the weekend with Tiffany Mack, our good friend. I have also been looking ahead to some travel that's going to be coming up. I'm going to be attending an archaeology conference. And I've been getting a lot of queries from people. Mike, are you going to be at the International UFO Congress this year? Because there had been some discussion, Matt, about the Graylian gang trying to get out there. I'm just not thinking it's going to be feasible at this point. And I'll tell you why, because being one of the most widely attended UFO conferences in the world, frankly, it's incredibly hard, even within 3 or 4 months of the event, to line up hotel space. I was talking to Martin Willis the other day, the host of Podcast UFO, went on his show. And he had said to me that the best he was able to do was get the next closest hotel and ask the people there at the resort where they hold the event in Fountain Hills. He said, I asked him, look, if you have an opening at all over the course of the weekend, call me and let me know. They said, well, sir, you know, we're really not supposed to do this. But sure enough, the guy ended up calling him and said, now you listen to me. That was the wrong guy, wrong concierge. But anyway, no, they called Martin and said, you know, we've actually had an opening. So if you want to come down, somebody didn't show up, we can accommodate you. And he was able to get in. Yeah, but to try and get the entire Graylian gang out there, it's a little more difficult. Okay, guys, real quick, one more thing that we've been doing. I did this over the weekend with Tiffany. I have questions that I want to ask each of you gentlemen before we get things rolling here on the show tonight. This is true. And Race Hobbs, I'm going to start with you, okay? Race?
Yes.
Hubbo. Okay, the first question, I want to ask you this, Race. What do you think about ghosts?
Try not to, a whole lot, but...
I mean, I've been told, a wise man once said, in fact, that if you have ghosts, you have everything.
That's right.
But I'll also say that I'm interested in personal ghost stories. Let me ask you, Race, do you or a family member have a personal ghost story? Or if not, do you have a strange story that a family member has ever told you?
Both, really.
Yeah.
I've seen what people describe as ghosts. Both in like an upper torso apparition and then a black shadow.
So you're saying that you've actually observed a corporeal revenant. Actually, that wouldn't be a corporeal. It would merely be a phantasmal revenant.
Or incorporeal.
Incorporeal, yeah. Where did you see a... That laugh, by the way. When my mother listens to the show, she always says, Race laughing makes her laugh.
but remember... Remember last week, we actually don't laugh here on the Graylian Report.
We don't.
It's all tracks. Yeah. Hob laughs.
All we laugh tracks, yeah.
We let Hobbo play the laugh track. Race, where did you see a ghost?
The first one I saw was in the street in front of my parents' home where I was born and raised. And the other that I saw was in my home about 7 years ago. We were moving and breaking down everything and packing everything up and moving. And I saw the black shadow in the back room. Me and my son actually saw it. We were going down the hallway to the far room on the very end of the hallway to the left, where it was the workout room where the treadmill and the weights and stuff were. And we were going there to break down the weight bench and everything. It was like the last thing we wanted to move. It was the heaviest and the most of it. So, right. And when we opened that door, he was in front of me. He took one step through the threshold and the whole room went black in front of us. And then normal again in just a second. And the only light in that room was coming. It was a corner room and there was two large windows there, one on each wall in front of us. And the only way that room could have gone dark was if something blocked the light out of both of those windows at the same time. And just, you know, the tick of a clock, it was just normal, black, normal. And it passed from right to left. You could tell it had motion across it. And it covered the whole doorway, the whole, you know, and it was... We both jumped instantly. He jumped back. I was already jumping back, so he didn't hit me. But we went several steps backwards from just being startled from it. He was, did you see that? Did you see? Of course I saw it. That's how you didn't hit me. I'm big, but I'm quick, Micah.
He's quick. This is true, folks. I have seen Race. Race is very quick. Very quick in action. I would have been scared too, Race, had I seen Solomon Grundy born on a Monday walking by the window pane. Now, I'll ask you too, Matt. Anybody in your family or you have a ghost story or a really strange story?
We never really did. There just wasn't a lot of focus on the kind of supernatural or anything in my family. I was obviously given a lot of kind of folk tales and local mythology.
I know
and
your
stuff
dad
like
enjoys
that.
Those, yeah.
Yeah, and it was always put into context of here's why, you know, he'd tell me the story of the Brown Mountain Lights or, you know, Blowing Rock, things like that. I really think, funny enough, my first real introduction, other than kind of getting into horror movies at a young age, with the kind of ghost mythos was Josh Warren's Haunted Asheville.
Oh, yeah.
When I was young, when it came out, I think I was 8 or 9, and my dad got me the book, and I read through it. Lo and behold, years later, you and I link up and all of that jazz, and that was really my first introduction was you and Josh.
Yeah. The ghost I'm most fascinated with at the current moment actually is the ghost of our internet connection. And I'll just mention people are tweeting at me and messaging me. Some in the chat room probably are saying also, Matt, there that we're having some issues. I know Race had mentioned there in the chat also. And the only thing I can gather is that it may be the inclement weather down here in Asheville. We've had storms moving through the area because coming back down, the audio sounds just fine to us here in the bunker. Unfortunately, the signal being sent back out via the radio relay isn't being picked up as clearly. It could also be the construction that they're doing on the Eiffel Tower, because that's where one of our Graylian relays is. There are two of them, okay? One on the Eiffel Tower, and then there's another one stateside, which I cannot mention for security reasons. That's where our two uplinks, and no, we don't go through Dial Global. No, we have our own private satellite interface. And unfortunately, it seems that there is something going on. Something is not connecting properly between point A and point B, which is always distressing. So
sounding good right now, though.
Well, good. As long as we sound good right now, maybe those folks out there, maybe our French friends are fixing the problem.
Well, they're boosting the wattage.
Boosting the wattage, yes.
As a brief interjection, after that enthralling story Hobbo told, we had a question here in the chat room asking about the quote-unquote sugar incident, Hob?
The sugar?
Oh, gosh.
Could you comment on the sugar incident?
I can briefly. I'll really quickly go through that one. That right there, whoever made that comment is an avid listener of this station. I had mentioned before about this happening. It was in a home that Robin and I had rented, a very old home, back when we first got together, like in 1998, 1999, somewhere around in there. And we were in our master bedroom. I was reading through the paper or something, doing something in my chair in there, and my dog Cheyenne jumped up and started barking at the door. The door to the master bedroom was wide open, led into the foyer out front and the kitchen area and dining room. And she just went to barking, hair standing up on her back. And she's looking at an angle across through, like she's looking into the kitchen. And, I honestly thought someone was like breaking into the house, like coming in through the laundry room and pantry room and through the dining room into the kitchen. And I got my pistol and I loaded it. I was just put the clip in it and put one in the chamber. And I start peeking around the corner real slow with my gun pointed out front. She's barking, never stops. Burr, 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 burr. I mean, just constant. And I'm slowly moving my way from right to left, moving around that doorway, thinking I'm going to see someone standing there. And I kept going and kept going and kept going until I could see straight down the wall. And there was no one in there. But as I was moving around that doorway, I noticed a bag of sugar on the countertop. It was sitting on the counter by itself, and it just kind of tilted and wobbled a little bit and stopped. And long story short, earlier that day, I had put a brand new bag of sugar into the canister on the sugar canister on the counter there. And I had folded that bag back up into a little folded rectangle and put it into the trash dispenser at the end of the counter. And I remember specifically doing that morning. I had to have sugar for the coffee, you know? So I checked I made sure the house was clear. I went over and I looked at this bag, and it looked full, as the sides were bulged as if it was a full bag of sugar, but it was empty. And I went to the end of the trash. By then, the hair on my back is standing up, and you know, it's just like the air is charged. I'm you know, starting to really get uneasy. I look and hope I see that bag there, and it wasn't there. It wasn't in the trash.
So you just started shooting, right?
That bag got out of the trash and got opened back up, and sort of like if someone put it over their mouth and inflated it back up to like a bulging full shape and then set it on the counter. That was really a weird thing to experience, to be honest with you.
I think we'll remember this one, ladies and gentlemen in the listening audience, as Sherlock Holmes case number 197, the case of the spectral sucrose.
The sugar lover.
Yeah, X-Lady threw that one out in the chat room there, so I was intrigued.
Yeah, that's a true story that really happened, and there was no one there. The back door was locked, secured. It had a chain, you know, the old chain, you know, so no one could have metal went out together, that door. Yeah. No one could have went out that door and chained the door shut behind them. It was impossible for someone to get out of that back door. I just have no answers for how that could be. And I actually saw the thing move. I saw it just stand up. It was standing up straight with my eyes locked on it, and it just tilted over a little bit and rocked and stopped.
That is indeed some weird, wild stuff. Hey, yeah. Either of you guys going to ask me if I've seen a ghost?
Have you seen a ghost or have any handed down?
Have you seen a spectral apparition?
Not everybody all at once. Well, I've never seen one myself, but I know someone who has.
what's your family handed down to you in the past?
They've handed down
an Omni.
Yeah. Well, I've never seen a ghost myself, but I know several people who have. And by the way, I got to pay homage to our good friend, our dear brother, Lee Spiegel, who, do you remember not this past Christmas, but a year before that, Christmas Eve here in the bunker. I spend Christmas Eve on Skype with Race Hobbs and Lee Spiegel from the Huffington Post, and we pulled up this hilarious audio of him. It wasn't Lee at all. It was on the Howard Stern show. It was Howard Stern impersonating Lee Spiegel. You know, hey, Lee, have you ever seen a ghost before? Well, I've never seen a ghost, but I know someone who has. It is one of the best things. I love Lee Spiegel.
Yeah, absolutely. Micah, you know, when we learned that Lee had worked with her, I mean, he was at WNBC.
He was.
When Howard Stern got his first gig there, and he worked with Howard Stern at WNBC throughout, you know, his tenure there when he got fired.
Yeah, but remember, Race, it's pronounced WNBC.
Yes, WNBC.
There you go.
And, but they worked together. And later, Howard Stern did about a 5-minute piece talking about working with Lee Spiegel.
Yeah.
It was very, very cool.
Robin's like, you know, what was he like to work with? And Howard's like, oh, you know, Lee was that kind of guy. He'd come in the room, you know, and, you know, you couldn't get him to stop talking. You'd want him to go out of the room and he'd just keep talking. You know, Lee, have you ever seen a UFO? I've never seen a UFO, but I know someone who has. But the great thing is Lee is the very one who brings us this audio, and we're all three sitting there cracking up. I mean, it really was funny. And Lee is just a gem of a human being. Now,
I've never seen one, but I wrote a great article in Omni.
In Omni, yes. Oh, Omni. Oh, I love it. Well, I'll tell you this, guys. Okay, coming back to the question that each of you asked, I've never seen a ghost, but I know somebody who says they have. No joke. And in fact, my family has told a lot of stories over the years, and the best one, I was talking with Tiffany Mack about this today, was a story that might, well, gosh, I mean, it's hard to say which is the best one. But my two quick favorites, and anyone who wants to hear the full story, if you're a Graylian X subscriber, you can get that on this week's podcast, Graylian X. The two that stick out in my mind are the one about my father's father, who had died mysteriously, but 1 week before he died, he saw a strange luminous phenomena, kind of like an earthlight or a ghost light. And as he was watching it on his way home from work, this was in rural South Carolina. Gosh, I mean, you know, again, probably close to the turn of the last century, if not before, this thing just disperses. This light just kind of explodes. He wasn't injured by it, but it was very strange. And then the other story, which again, the full story, we talk about it more in depth on the podcast for subscribers, but my great-grandfather, Cordell, had said, that, walking home from work one day, that there was a little dog that began following him, and for several days thereafter, this little dog would walk alongside him, and he said, finally, after a whole week of every day on the way home, walking past this particular yard, the little dog would start walking along next to him. He said, I reached down to pet the little dog. This is on the fourth or fifth day. I think he said it was on a Friday. And he said, I reached down to pet the little dog, and my hand went right through him. Yeah. So, a spectral revenant of a dog, a canine ghost, as it were. Matt, that could be your first book. Has anyone written a book called Dog Ghosts? I know there's a book called Cat Ghosts.
I'm not sure. I'm going to have to look this up.
I hope that somebody out there's got a book called Dog Ghosts. No, I hope they don't, so that Matt can write that book. You know, but if Matt doesn't write it, I know somebody who will. Okay, we're just having some fun this first segment. We're going to get to news here in a moment, and then a little later, some listener emails before we get into some talk about superstition. I ain't superstitious. How about you? I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report, and we'll be back right after this.
You're listening to the KGRA Digital Broadcasting Station, Van Buren, Arkansas, Sarasota, Florida.
The high mountains of Appalachia. It is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. You know, in this segment to come, we're going to talk a little bit about alien life out there, which is something that we revisit from time to time on this show. I also want to look, though, at the idea that there could be what would seem to be very alien interactions that occur right here on Earth from time to time, and I do think that that is the case. Consider, for instance, what happened back in 2014. We had an isolated indigenous tribe in the Amazon rainforest. And there were pictures that were released of this. I mean, it was quite fascinating to actually see this interaction unfolding. The people, they were painted. They were very curious about what was hovering in the sky above them as the helicopter took photographs of this as yet uncontacted tribe. And the National Post had reported at the time But again, according to the Brazilian government's Indian Affairs Department, this had been the very first contact with mainstream society that these people had ever had. But some feared that the peaceful encounter with Brazilian government scientists in Acre State near the Peruvian border could have been a dangerous development for the uncontacted people, who are said to be extremely vulnerable to illnesses like the common cold. And in fact, the journal Science had also reported on June 29th of that year that the encounter was reportedly the government's first with an uncontacted tribe of this sort. The very first with an uncontacted tribe since 1996. I think that there are over 70-some uncontacted tribes out there. And you can only imagine that people who would have this kind of an experience would feel that their experience was an awful lot like seeing aliens or gods or deities in its own right. One can only imagine what that would be like. As interesting as it is for us anthropologically to see uncontacted people, what do they think when they see the helicopter hovering in the sky? They're pointing, they're thinking, oh, wow, it's the end of the world. This is one of our gods. These are the crazy people that we hear about from time to time that we don't have contact with, but we know about their existence. They may know well what else is happening in the world, even without internet connections. They may have information. They may have sources, some of them. It's an interesting conundrum. And as we look for alien life, I think, once again, we're always talking about, we got to get off planet. We got to find out what's going on out there, but there's so much to learn right here. I got to tell you really quickly, too. There's a guy who I have heard through the grapevine, listens to this show from time to time. His name is Sean Stone, and yes, he happens to be related to the famous director of the same last name. And Sean Stone, of course, is the host of a program called Buzzsaw. Have you ever watched this show before, Matt?
I haven't seen this.
Buzzsaw, it's an interesting program. And one of the recent editions that they have released is called The Spiritual Heart of Our World with Jordeo Sousa. And they talk in this episode about the Yanawana people, described, of course, as protectors and keepers of secrets of the rainforest. And they've come under fire by major corporations seeking to exploit the energy resources of the Amazon basin. But these rainforests of South America have been likened to the lungs of the planet by many. And what if they were also the spiritual heart of the world? That's an interesting question. Now, Jordeo Sousa conveys this mission of the Yanawana to protect a bevy of treasures ranging from medicines to the secrets of spiritual awakening, and these are things which await those willing to form a deep connection with the planet and its healing power, but will be destroyed if the Amazon is lost. It just goes to show that studying cultures and people's beliefs and their values, their systems of belief, one reason we're going to be looking again in the next hour at superstitions, we can learn a lot about ourselves and also the way that we are connected with the world. And the great thing is that Buzzsaw, that program, is one of the fine programs that is offered by the folks at Gaia. And so I want to tell you, as I often do, that if you go to Gaia.com, that's GAIA.com/Graylian, you can log in and you can personalize an account where you can stream programs like Buzzsaw. You can stream a lot of programs that talk about these sorts of things. And I think it's incredibly important to try and take ourselves outside of our comfort zone and out of our usual frame of reference. Stop and consider what people's personal values and belief systems are and what that can relay to us if we are willing to stop and listen for long enough. That's Gaia.com, GAIA.com/Graylian. Do check out some of the programs they provide and some of the selections we have offered for you through that personalized page. Do check that out. What's going on in other news? I do want to get to some of the happenings of the week, and boy, there is a lot. Where do we begin? You know, first of all, Matt, talking about that ceremonial soma that we talk about here in the bunker from time to time, that's right, beer, or as we call it, dad juice. There are scientists who are now saying that in the name of science, that they're going to try and brew beer on the moon, or at very least, see if beer can be brewed on the moon. Now, this is important.
It is.
And do you know why it's important?
Because if we get off planet one day, we're going to need beer. That's just the established law of the universe, I feel.
Well, that is one interpretation, and in fact, it may be the truest interpretation of all this. Well, listen, the Telegraph reports that it may not seem that the most urgent question currently facing space and science, but a team of researchers has nevertheless launched a plan to find out whether beer can be successfully brewed on the moon. Scientists from the University of California are designing a fermentation vessel the size of a fizzy drinks can. The Telegraph, a fizzy drinks can? I guess we'd call that a soda or a pop here in the States, huh? But they hope that they'll be able to use these and transport these on an Indian spacecraft due to blast off later this year. They say finding out, and this is what they say the importance of this actually is, if we can use this to find out how yeast behaves in lunar conditions, This will be important for the development of pharmaceuticals and yeast-containing foods, like bread in space. So before we can have bread in space, beer in space, okay? Order of operations. Priorities, folks. Got to have those priorities. They say, rather than separating the fermentation and carbonation stages as normally occurs during brewing, the team plans to combine them, thereby eliminating the need altogether to release accumulated carbon dioxide, which could endanger a spacecraft. Our canister is designed based on actual fermenters, the team says, and it contains three compartments. The top will be filled with unfermented beer. The second will contain the yeast. And when the rover lands on the moon with our experiment, a valve will open between the two compartments, allowing the two to mix. Now, once the yeast has done its job, a second valve will open to allow it to sink to separate from the now fermented beer. The team is one of 25 selected from a pool of 3,000 people, or groups rather, actually, so even more than that, to compete for a spot for its experiment aboard the Team Indus spacecraft, which is set to launch on December 28th, 2017. The question I have is, what role does gravity play in the brewing process? To my knowledge, except for the assumption that maybe somewhere aliens on a planet similar to Earth and with access to the same sorts of material resources that we have, that they may have also stumbled upon the ancient fermentation process of brewing.
We can only hope so.
We can only hope, yeah, because then when they get here or we get there, we'll have something in common.
Yeah.
We may not speak the same language, but we can sit down and we can crack one and enjoy it.
Right.
But I mean, the important thing here is that it will be interesting to see how something like a fermentation process occurs in an environment. You know, again, on the moon, it won't be zero gravity by any means, but it will be a very different environment from that here on Earth.
Well, what role would that play in the carbonation process? And as you said, just the mixing and fermentation of the ingredients.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
It's going to be really interesting. This is also interesting. Sometimes the answer to a question presents us with more questions. And that may be the case with the eighth and the penultimate, perhaps, chapter of the Star Wars saga, the title of which was just announced today. This is not a spoiler, because if you're going to go to the theaters to see this, eventually you're going to have to know what the movie's called. It will be Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi. Now, this title was released by the Disney-owned Lucasfilm, which has produced the Star Wars saga and its spin-off film since 1977, as reported by SMH.com. The title immediately sent the internet into speculation overdrive over whether the saga's principal hero, the Jedi Knight Luke Skywalker, is indeed the last Jedi referred to in the title. Or, others suggest, it might also refer to Rey, played by Daisy Ridley, who was introduced in Episode 7, The Force Awakens, a year ago. So, is it going to be... Boy, this is getting scary here in the bunker.
It is.
Yeah,
I think we may have ghosts.
Yes. Are you seeing this? We do have ghosts. Yeah, this is really getting scary. Race, do we still have a connection with you, buddy? Because I think we're experiencing some poltergeist activity. Race. Yeah, I just lost the audio. Yeah, I do have a backup here, but I just hope the backup's going to sound...
You're listening to The Graylian Report.
There are a lot of scary things out on the road. You never know what might pop up. Where wearing your safety belt is the law. It keeps you safe. And it could protect you from zombies.
A public service announcement brought to you by Graylin International and your friends at Hermits United.
McCoy is right in pointing out the enormous danger potential in any contact with life and intelligence as fantastically advanced as this. But I must point out that the possibilities, the potential for knowledge and advancement is equally great. Risk. Risk is our business. That's what the starship is all about. That's why we're aboard her.
And back on the airwaves once again, alien abduction might have just ensued. We may have been deneuralized. I'm still trying to figure out exactly where we've been, but we're back from there and glad to be here. As we report on Star Wars, I think that the Empire may have just tried to interrupt our broadcast, Mr. Oakley.
Maybe so. I have no recollection of any of it, so.
You were deneuralized. I know it. Exactly. This is why I keep a sonic screwdriver in my pocket. It helps ward off against that. Scalar interferometry, my dear boy. But, well, that was really strange, and I guess we'll try and pick up where we left off. Glad you guys are all there. So we're still somewhere, in hour one, but it seems that there's a certain non-linearity that we're dealing with tonight. You know what I mean? Non-linearity?
I do.
In other words, things aren't happening in the proper order tonight. And when we have a full system shutdown like that, that much I do remember. Then the wacky music plays and we got to start over again. So we'll wrap up this hour and then we'll pick up again in hour two and, well, continue the job that we intended to do on this fine evening. So this new Star Wars film, it's got its new title. Somebody, see, that's what it was, Matt. They didn't want me to talk about the title.
Exactly. Disney has done far more subversive things throughout their history, and I wouldn't put this past them.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't like us dropping spoilers. Well, anyway, so maybe we won't say too much more about that. I will say one thing, though, okay? So I recently did finally get to the theaters and see Rogue One.
Did you?
Or maybe I'm going to do that tomorrow. Huh.
I don't know.
Weird.
I've only seen it once.
Yeah. So. No, I really did see it. But I don't want to give away any spoilers, but I will just say this.
I think you're the last person in the world to have seen it, really.
Well, no, trust me. Yes, I may be the last person in the world to have seen the film, but as soon as I make any kind of statement about the final 3 minutes of the movie, you know, I'll get hate mail. So I'm not going to do that, but I will just say this. The film was all the more poignant to me, having seen it after the death of actress Carrie Fisher. And, of course, knowing that Lucasfilms has decided that they're not going to, well, Lucasfilm, actually, but Disney, you know, they own them. They're not going to be doing digital reconstructions of Carrie Fisher for the new film or either of the new films. So The Last Jedi, it may remain to be seen who exactly they're talking about, but of course it's going to be minus one Princess Leia. Where are you tonight? Yes, indeed. Well, it's really sad. So, and yeah, that made the film very poignant for me in seeing it. Now, seeing as how we just kind of came out of limbo ourselves, Matt, we might as well get to the story about physicists who say that they may have just manipulated pure nothingness. Did you see this?
I did.
And then after this, I also want to talk a little bit about, again, when you have a complete system shutdown, what are the things that can cause that? And one of them is a particular kind of a catastrophe that we haven't really reported on yet, but I do want to spend a little time talking about. And it's one that people in the scientific community really say we should worry about. But if there's one scientific field on the forefront of conceptual paradoxes like time travel and getting mixed up like we have, gone wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey. You know, it's quantum theory. And in quantum theory, nothing actually is something, at least sort of. Now, it was reported recently by MNN.com that according to quantum theory, and this is one of my favorite things about it, the vacuum is actually not completely empty. Virtual particles do exist in this area. And not to go off on a complete tangent here, but the Casimir effect is what comes to mind here, because we won't get into that right now. But according to quantum mechanics, even an empty vacuum, again, is not really empty. It's filled with these vertical particles that blink in and out of existence in time spans that are too short for us to be able to even observe. And therefore, nothingness on a quantum level exists on a level of intuitive absurdity, a kind of existence that is paradoxical, but in some conceptual sense, it is nonetheless necessary. So now this report picking up again, it reads that science isn't usually comfortable dealing with the phenomena that we can't observe. And that's what makes this latest breakthrough from physicists at the University of Konstanz in Germany so very profound and important, because according to their research, recently published in the journal Nature, the nothingness that exists on the quantum level is not only something, but its fluctuations can be grasped, manipulated, and indeed, perhaps they can be observed, contrary to everything that we thought. And that's not supposed to be possible, at least on the quantum level. But one of the truly mind-bending axioms of quantum mechanics is the idea that you can't measure something on the quantum level without fundamentally doing what, Matt?
Changing it.
That's right. In other words, as soon as you attempt to observe some quantum system, the very act of observing the system destroys or changes it. Now, at the University of Konstanz, these researchers are aiming to completely unravel our knowledge of all this. And what they're claiming goes against the fundamental principle that we all thought we knew here. They claim, in fact, to have peered directly into the darkness and to have seen it for what it truly is. Did it peer back at them? I can't help but wonder. Nietzsche would like to know. Or at least, they say they believe that they've uncovered a method for actually observing things on the quantum level without destroying them. So how did they do it? Their method essentially involves firing a super short laser pulse lasting only a few femtoseconds, which, Matt, if you're counting, that's measured on the level of millionths of billionths of a second. And they fire this into a squeezed vacuum, not squeegeed, but a squeezed vacuum. As the light fires through the vacuum, subtle changes in the polarization of the light can be analyzed to reveal a map of sorts of the quantum nothingness. And they say that the squeezing of the vacuum is the real magic of this method, because perhaps the easiest way to think about it relates to what happens when you squeeze a balloon, you know, and it makes that underleg noise that we're all fond of. You've seen that, what was that? The Pee-wee movie. That was the only thing anybody liked about it, was the scene where he stood there with the balloon, squeezing the balloon, you know?
Forever.
Yeah.
That was hilarious.
Yeah. Well, the principle, okay, applies, where they say a balloon expands and tightens in some areas if you squeeze it, and it feels depleted in others. But again, does quantum nothingness, if squeezed in the same way, does it make rude underleg noises? I see, many questions remain here, don't they?
This is the kind of discourse the scientific community refuses to have, but the rest of us want to hear.
We really want to know.
Yeah.
Just like brewing beer on the moon. I mean, these are important things, right?
Absolutely.
You know why? This is science!
Stand back.
Stand back, ladies and gentlemen. Science is about to happen. Yeah. Now, of course, these all kidding aside, this study does have its limitations, and at best, they say it merely represents our first foray into the something that mysteriously permeates the void. And it's an encouraging first step, however, one that promises to peer deeper at the philosophical absurdities of existence than ever before. What's interesting, though, is that there was this kind of an archaic idea that there was no such thing as nothingness, that there was something that did indeed fill the void and permeate all of existence where nothing appeared to be, and that was what we called the ether. Wouldn't it be weird if, in some sort of a sense, we come back around to the idea that there is indeed an ether? And if we further are to extrapolate that this might indeed affect things like gravity and our knowledge of space-time and the cosmos, general relativity, what may it mean? Will we be rewriting parts of the history books, well, the science books, or maybe the history of science books in the coming years?
Maybe all books.
Rewrite all the books.
Yeah.
All you avid readers out there, get ready, because we got a bunch of new books coming your way in
That's
2017
right.
and 2018 and 2019 and 2020, for that matter, 2030. 2045, 2075, I could go on, really, all night. We won't do that. Now, here's something else, Matt. I did want to talk about this a little, because we've talked about an awful lot of things tonight. And one of them that I really wanted to touch on is the fact that right now space weather forecasters are looking ahead with a lot of concern in 2017 and in all of the years I've aforementioned to come with regard to the potential for crippling solar storms. You had a story right here that was talking about this.
Yeah, I'm not sure that this is exactly what affected us here in the studio tonight.
That's why it was on my mind.
Yeah, exactly. but apparently once every 100 years or so, Earth is actually bombarded with energy from a massive solar storm. And a new study shows just how high the cost of the event could actually be. And I was looking around, and Gizmodo reports that researchers put the cost of flare-induced blackouts at about $41.5 billion per day in the United States alone.
Now, that's if we had a Carrington-like event, that's how much we'd be spending?
Or exactly.
What the cost would be? Okay. What would we be spending it on, though? Because nobody would be doing anything, right?
Well, apparently a large flare could knock out transformers across the globe, causing widespread disruption of power grids, things like that.
$40 billion per day in reparation costs.
$41.5 billion per day in the United States alone for repairs and things like that.
Interesting. Well, you know, I got this other article here that's talking about, again, the legitimate concern for things like this, Carrington-like events. Again, if you look up online, rather than us going into it right now, if you go back and you look at the Carrington event, you'll see the magnitude of damage that was done when our electrical grid was in its infancy. Now, you apply that to today with all the digitization of, well, everything, with all the summation of mankind's knowledge stored on the intangible data cloud that is the World Wide Web. And we think about what could happen if one of these Carrington-like events were to happen. We worry about asteroids. You know, the EMP, the natural EMP that would result from one of these violent, crippling, in fact, solar storms, as they call them, could really get bad. I've got this space weather report here. As ridiculous as it sounds, they say, the fiery rolling sun was tame in 2016. Despite all the worries about climate change and everything, they said it spewed very few solar storms and had minimal impact on our electrical digital life on Earth. But our star is in a declining phase of activity, and it sounds good on paper, but seemingly quiet moments on the sun can still produce crippling geomagnetic storms. Now, huge eruptions of radiation and plasma from the surface of the sun can, if headed toward Earth, impact or bring down the entire electrical grid in theory. This would, you know, cease all radio communications. This would take down most GPS systems. It would also potentially expose passengers in flight to dangerous levels of radiation. And, of course, we already, during high-latitude flights, if you fly a lot every year, you're still exposed to more of that than the average person. But during one of these solar storms, it could get, you know, really dangerous. And they can last, of course, for days or weeks or months, depending on the strength of the invisible storm. So, again, maybe that's a factor we should consider here, too. If a solar storm lasts for days or weeks or months, maybe that $41.5 billion that they're talking about per day, apply that to a storm that could last for months. This could be really bad news.
You'd easily tack up an additional national deficit just in that.
Well, yeah. But this would not just be something that would affect one country. Presumably,
No. You
know, all of Earth would be affected. And there was a storm kind of like this in 2012 that was particularly concerning. They said that the near miss was moving even faster than the historic Carrington event of 1859 had done. And if that type of event ever happened in the 21st century, some suggest it would knock us back into the Stone Age. You know, Matt, again, I often mention this in relation to these kind of stories, One Second After by William R. Forstchen.
It's a great book. I'm yet to read the follow-up yet.
Yeah, I asked him about that, in fact, and because he had a copy at the event that we did here in Asheville with George Norrie. And he says, I said, could I, you know, that's your new book. I can't wait to read that. He says, yeah, it'll be out in January. So I guess it is out. Actually, Bill and I, we did catch up and talk a good bit. And I've invited him on this show before, and he travels a lot like I do. But he, of course, has said, you know, would love to come on and talk about it because he says, you know, even years after having written that book, I can't emphasize enough the importance of what this could mean for humankind in the coming years. And that's what I really appreciate about Bill Forstchen. He really takes this seriously and is one of those people who has looked into the possible repercussions of something like that happening in modern times. Let's hope that that's not going to be the case, but in the years to come, add it to the list of potential dangers that we should certainly take seriously. And looking ahead, we'll be back, of course, here in mere moments. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah. He is Matt. Stay with us.
the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Fresh back from the space-time vortex, I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. As we attempt to continue our dispatches from across space and time, the last you may have heard from us, depending on what order chronologically you are listening, you may have heard me saying that things were getting really weird. We attempted to send out a distress signal, and then we lost all contact with the outside world. Matt and I were thrust into a reality unlike that which we are used to seeing. And Matt, it was a little scary there for a moment.
I'm still shaking up.
So, I've never in the entire history of my time as a broadcaster ever had anything quite like that happen. And I'll explain to you here in a moment what that was. Now, this is the live show, keep in mind, so everyone listening live, you're hearing this as it's happening. Podcasters will have already had some foreknowledge of what has happened, which is kind of weird because that I'm talking about, Matt, has not happened yet. Because we are yet to explain that to the podcast audience, but they will have already heard about it because they know before we say this now.
That's the vortex you were talking about.
Exactly. This whole time travel thing, it can be confusing at times unless you're a professional. If you're a trained professional and you know what you're doing like I happen to be, well, then you're in good hands. Trust your doctor. Now, I do want to remind everybody, do check out Graylian X. Okay, that's graylianreport.com/X. You can subscribe to additional content that we provide. If you are not already a subscriber, if you want to become a podcaster and do like Matt and I do, become a doctor or a reverend or a corporeal revenant or whatever else you might want to be in, check out the complete guide to Maverick Podcasting, which is available at maverickpodcasting.org. So what happened tonight? I think that this week's episode of the show, Matt, should just be called What Happened That Night in the Bunker.
I think that is the perfect title for it.
It was a little weird. Things got a little unusual.
Some weird, wild stuff.
We were sitting here in the studio, and all of a sudden, it was like something out of a scene.
Well, it was like a rave initially.
Well, it was, yeah. One might liken it to being like a rave. I would say it was like a scene out of the film Poltergeist.
Yeah.
The lights start flickering and flashing rapidly and inexplicably. Matt and I are looking at each other, and I asked Race, I said, Race, have you still got us? Can you hear us? Apparently, this went to air. People were hearing us describing something really strange going on, and then we were apparently lost for 15 minutes. Seems more like five on our end, doesn't it, Matt?
Of course.
This is weird. I knew it was going to be one of those weird nights, and I told you, if you have ghosts, you have everything. Well, so we did that thing. We start talking about ghosts, and then some almost ghostly stuff starts happening in the bunker. I mentioned there was some inclement weather outside. Maybe that had something to do with this, but I've been on the air live during many storms, both rain and snow. I've never had the lights start flickering suddenly and do that for a minute straight. Matt and I are sitting here going, have you ever seen anything like that before?
No. What was really strange about it is that we were like, okay, we got to see if the rest of the bunker is like this. So we step out of the studio here and we walk right down the hall to the kitchen. All the lights are on.
All the lights are on in the kitchen. Studio B, I don't think we had any lights on in there, so I didn't see if there was power in that portion of the bunker. But, I mean, this was one of the weirdest things where there was light in half of the bunker. It was almost as though what?
X-Lady has it nailed here in the chat room. Russian hackers.
You know what's funny about that? So what I didn't tell you guys, I have all weekend, in fact, been on tech support. And our service providers have tech support that is supplied by Russia. And so I've been talking with Russian IT experts all weekend, and I joked with myself. I said, you know, after this election, somebody's going to hack the Graylian Report. Yeah, we just got hacked by the Russians, the Ruskies. That's right. They got us, didn't they?
Oh, man.
It happens sometimes, I guess.
Cold War all over.
Really strange. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being superstitious.
Or just a little stitious.
Yeah.
Super, not superstitious, but well, a little.
You know, I'd said, though, tonight, Matt, that we would talk about superstitions, traditions about superstitions. And, I mean, this story, as it were, for this podcast has all but written itself for us. With everything weird going on in here in the studio, I mean, you and I being thrust into darkness, we're sitting here with the one the what would you call that? The backup light. And we're just kind of sitting here, hey, Matt, in complete and utter silence.
And I look at you and I go, where are we going? Into darkness.
Into darkness, yes. Yeah, well, we went into darkness, all right. So, okay. So that's where we are, live listeners. And I wanted to get into a little discussion about superstitions. Before we do that, I also wanted to get into just a few listener emails, but I've got, before we get into that, one news story that if I didn't touch on this, I wouldn't be doing my job as a broadcaster. And this, of course, involves a lot of outlets reporting about this, talking about what are believed to be about 12 million pages now of declassified CIA files that are available online for everyone to view. Yes, some of this involves UFOs. Yes, some of this involves psychic technologies that were being tested and test-driven by various different agencies. And news.com.au reports, for 17 years, the U.S. Army's Project Stargate explored the use of psychokinesis, ESP, and telepathy for military and domestic intelligence operations. And while explored in 2004 in a book, and then also in the film of the same name, The Men Who Stare at Goats, very few details of the program had ever been easily accessible to the public. Well, this all changed when the CIA posted a vast cache of close to 12 million pages of declassified documents online, which include information on UFO sightings, Nazi war crimes, Project Stargate, and other secret files. The information was first released back in 1995 when then-President Bill Clinton ordered all documents with historical value that were at least 25 years old to be declassified. However, the documents were only physically accessible from four computer terminals, and those were all located at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. Now, in 2000, the CIA released the documents on its electronic records search tool, Crest, but the files were still only available if you physically went to the National Archives to view these. So following an FOIA lawsuit in 2014, the CIA said it would post, and you can probably see why when I give you this number, why they were dawdling on this. The CIA finally agreed to post the 930,000 documents online in entirety, but claimed it would take 6 years to scan every page. I mean, you know, this is when you go downstairs to the lowest level bunker where you have the monkeys on the typewriters writing Shakespeare, and you put these guys to work.
That's right.
Yeah. Put those little prosimians to work. Now, the CIA Information Management Director said that the agency was able to complete the project quicker than expected, and with the official giving assurances that nothing had been omitted and that the half-century of data was published in its entirety. They said access to this historically significant collection is no longer limited by geography. We've been working on this for a very long time, and this is one of the things I want to make sure I got done before I left. And now you can access it from the comfort of your own home. So I'm interested. I haven't actually had a chance yet to really dig into these documents, and although they reveal a lot of information that has already been publicly available thanks to the diligent work of other researchers who have gone to the National Archives and sat down and poured through these documents, you know, to be able to go through these now from our own home, Matt, you and I could spend more than 6 years probably going through everything that the CIA has just released, and so maybe we should do that. I'm tasking you now. I'm going to give you a pay raise, and every week I want you to find a new CIA document that we are going to feature on the Grayling Report. I'm just kidding. But actually, even though I was kidding, that would almost be like a cool thing.
It might be, yeah.
We feature a different archive or file from these, but you know, it would require having to go through, and we would have to, you know, physically select one every week that we would want to use. So I don't know if that's worth our time. Maybe we could actually, at very least, intermittently revisit these and report on things that we find that may be of significance to our ongoing research that maybe the media is not reporting. But here are a few things that the media has reported already. So first of all, we have from 1952 to 1956 a tunnel. Okay, the U.S. had built a 400-meter tunnel that would be used to tap Soviet telephone lines. This was called the Berlin Tunnel Operation. Of course, we had a lot of UFO sightings that were reported in these declassified documents. One such report documents a UFO spotted by two police officers patrolling the Lithuanian border back in 1996. And it was reported in the document that vehicle loads of soldiers from the ARAS, Rapid Reaction Force, sniffer dogs, and police reinforcements immediately arrived on the scene of the emergency. According to eyewitness accounts, they noticed a spherical object hanging and pulsing. At the same time, they heard what they described as a strange sound like an electric or an electronic crackle. Now, when they moved about 50 meters through the long grass, the police said that the sphere moved away, rose higher, and rapidly departed. The report said that those who attended the scene studied the area carefully and recorded the strange sound, which could still be heard even though the UFO had already left the area. Huh. That's pretty interesting, actually. Maybe it would be worth our time to look at some more of these. Of course, some of the documents do also deal with the aforementioned Project Stargate. As mentioned earlier, this is the name given to the U.S. Army's investigations into the potential for psychic phenomena in military and domestic intelligence applications, and studies of paranormal phenomena have nearly always been associated with the controversy. Despite the controversy concerning their nature and existence, many organizations continue to avidly be interested in these phenomena, a report read. Another report reads, the intelligence community is no exception, The intelligence community is no exception. Beginning in the 1970s, it had conducted a program intended to investigate the application of one paranormal phenomenon, remote viewing or the ability to describe locations one had not visited. As an adjunct method to gathering intelligence, people who possessed this ability could be asked to describe various intelligence targets. This information, especially if considered credible and reliable, could supplement and enhance more time-consuming and perhaps dangerous methods for collecting data. The report concluded that observations provided a compelling argument against the continuation of the research program with little evidence demonstrating the existence of remote viewing. Glad to know how our taxpayer dollars were used. But then again, I mean, that's the whole thing, is that often there are rather interesting things that are explored to see if there's any legitimacy to them. And even if the scientific community maintains, an unapologetic skepticism toward these kind of things, it's been shown time and time again that military government organizations, they will give at least credence to these ideas in terms of exploration to see if, well, hey, is this something, whether or not science understands it, that we can use to our benefit? Is this something that we can use and find beneficial, or in a way that is, opportunistically beneficial to us, we might say. So that's something to consider. Interesting. And of course, I wanted to touch on that just for a moment, but I think that in the weeks to come, we'll probably find more interesting things as some of these, again, six years worth that didn't quite take 6 years of CIA documents that have been disclosed online. Are you sitting over there reading those documents?
I actually just pulled up the CIA's website here, and they have a full section on the CREST project, and it's actually broken down into little sections that you can go into here. So they've got Berlin Tunnel, Consolidated Translations, General CIA Records, Ground Photo Caption Cards, JPRS, Library of Congress, NGA Records, NIS, OSS Collection, Scientific Abstracts, Secret Writing. Yes, Stargate, President's Daily Brief, things like that.
Interesting.
There are a couple more. Yeah, it's really neat. It's broken down really well.
Yeah,
for anybody who wants to go out there. And I put the link in the chat room, but maybe we can throw that up on the show notes.
Yeah,
after.
Of course. Yeah. Let's get to some listener emails here briefly before we continue into the next segment where we do discuss these superstitions. I don't know, after tonight, I might actually end up being superstitious or I might find good reason to become superstitious. Scott writes, and this is an addendum to what we talked about last week. He said, just a thought on D.B. Cooper's clip-on tie. I believe he would have worn the clip-on tie as a safety feature at the facility or the machine shop he worked in. Think about this. If he actually worked in a machine shop or as engineer in the shop, he would be around mills and lathes, drill presses, machinery, etc. A clip-on tie could easily be pulled off if it were ever to become tangled or caught in a piece of machinery, whereas a traditional tie could be a death sentence if the same were to occur. Just a thought. Thank you for that, Scott. That's, an interesting perspective. Jay in South Carolina also writes, I'm a longtime listener to the Grayling Report in Middle Theory and have nearly sent you a note a number of times. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess this isn't the Jay that we were thinking it was, because the Jay that we know has sent numerous emails. So
yeah.
Hard to keep up with all of them. I apologize, Jay, or both Jays, whichever Jay this is. He says, when listening to the D.B. Cooper episode, I think that there's a fairly simple explanation for why someone might wear a clip-on. If an engineer or supervisor had to go out to a manufacturing floor frequently to inspect the product or help analyze failures, a clip-on tie would be a lot faster to remove around dangerous equipment. Says the same thing. Quick and easy to get back on also once they're back in the more office setting. It would likely become so routine that taking it off before doing something where loose articles might pose a problem, like parachuting out of a plane, hypothetically, that they would do it by rote rather than with any conscious choice. Keep up the great work, Jay. Thank you, Jay. I got to give credit where credit is due, because I know that there's going to be somebody sitting out there rolling his eyes. Jeremy London was the first guy the day after the show. He said, look, just a thought about D.B. Cooper, dude. First of all, not only were clip-on ties more popular back then, but this would have been a safety hazard had he had something tied around his neck. If he's going out there and inspecting these areas, that tie could have gotten caught in any number of different kinds of machinery, and that way the clip-on tie would be able to be easily and quickly removed, and thus a protective measure. So I got to give props to my brother Jeremy, one of our producers of the Graylian Report in Nashville, Tennessee, because, yeah, he was the very first who pointed it out. And Jeremy, maybe now you feel vindicated because everybody has now, of course, written in. And these aren't the only two. I've had a lot of tweets and other things, people saying, look, the clip-on tie was probably a safety measure. Yeah. Alden writes, noon to you, Micah. First of all, I want to thank you for continuing to put out content for free without too many ads. And secondly, Gaia is awesome. Hey, cool. I'm glad that you like it. He says, without further ado, I wanted to share some information on the CIA's declassified Stargate documents, which we just reported on. How convenient. He said, I just came across them, and it seems to show that the CIA and by extension the NSA have been continuing experiments a la MK Ultra in the vein of learning more about parapsychology, telekinesis, and telepathy. It sounds ludicrous. Matt, are we experiencing an earthquake now?
We might be.
Well, this is just one of those nights. Did you just feel the ground shake?
I didn't feel it, but I heard it shake.
I felt,
which sounds strange, but
I felt the cave walls trembling just now. Oh, I just hope that everything isn't lost again. This is going to be a really interesting podcast for everybody listening. So anyway, getting back to Alden's email, bear with me for a moment, he says, because I realize how insane this all sounds. The stories you hear about people feeling like they're talking to loved ones in dreams, for instance, or about telepathy in general, or automatic writing, are possibly the practical application of this strange human ability. Chances are it isn't just limited to humans, but also probably animals and maybe, if they exist, ETs. I've experienced this phenomena for many years, and I've used it to communicate with friends, family, and even the dead. The CIA probably figured this out in the 1950s during their initial experiments with mind control and mental manipulation. What they've discovered is that it's possible to remotely view somebody or some information despite distance or physical barriers. They've used this to physically spy on the Soviets back in the day, and that they likely continue to use these techniques in the modern day. Now, could aliens have come to Earth? And if so, could they be advanced enough to use this kind of communication? Well, my main question is, why the hell did they reveal this? Also, are they utilizing these psychic techniques to remotely view U.S. citizens via the public information about ourselves online and gain through the NSA's U.S. Patriot Act activities spying on us? The question is no longer if or even how, but why? What kind of manipulation are they planning or conducting? Should we believe that all of this activity is exclusively for the purpose of, quote, stopping terrorists, unquote? And how exactly do we define a terrorist? I define it as someone or a group of someone's aiming to cause fear, but the government defines it as people who are working against their operations. And again, I'll note, Alden, that after 9/11, of course, the FBI changed their definition of terrorist. Now, even me sending this email probably flags both of us, assuming that we haven't been on radar anyway, as people who are meddling with the truth. There's been a lot of deception going on in the last 70 years, and we're being kept blind. There's a reason that they release this information now, and it's probably because whatever they've got going on now is much more advanced. Sometimes I'm scared because of this, and then I remember the plan is to keep us dumb and happy. Are you happy? Alden. P.S. I don't know if you still smoke a tobacco pipe, but there's a place up here in the Twin Cities that you might like. They have awesome selections of aromatic and English, and the guys that work there are really nice. I also wanted to thank you for pointing me in the direction of Mirage Men last year. I read it and was very impressed by Mark's thorough work. I'm also now significantly more worried about disinformation. Call me paranoid, but it seems that when people try to figure out what's going on, the government takes matters into their own hands. And then he links the CIA documents. And finally, he says, P.S., I'm sure you already are familiar with this stuff. I just like your opinions, especially the opinions of Matt and Chris. Chris McCollum, of course, on our sister broadcast, Middle Theory. So, Matt, there you go. Somebody does respect you.
Finally.
Somebody respects our lackey in chief.
That's right. I've been waiting for years for someone to say just that, so I truly appreciate it.
For someone to call you lackey in chief?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, by the way.
Not the first part. Not the compliment part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lackey in chief. Well, in truth, you know, again, I'd mentioned on the show, I think just last week, that there are skeptical minds out there who say that being a ridiculer can be instrumental in teaching people new things. Well, I disagreed, and I will, again, maintain my disagreement that we need to ridicule each other. However, me ridiculing my co-hosts, that I do for pure sport, and it's something I've done often and with gusto on this program over the years. So, Matt, you are a lackey, and that's why we love you.
Hey, love being one.
I'm just kidding. Anyway, thank you, Alden, and everybody else who wrote in with your emails. When we come back, I want to go down the list. We're going to look at some strange superstitions around the world, as I hope that we maintain our primary broadcast feed. It is the Graylian Report. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Dark heart of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report, rounding out this week's episode, strangely discombobulated. As we have been grounded, our feed has been taken down. At times, we're back, I think, now. Although I'm no longer, Matt, sure exactly what day of the week it even is.
It's hard to say at this point.
We normally broadcast Mondays from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe on the KGRA radio network, but it's been a strange experiment in space-time, so we'll leave it to the listeners to determine when and where we are. Well, maybe the good Lord can help there. Thanks, Hunter. But I do want to talk about something here. As we are rounding out, we're coming up over the hill and we're coming down the other side and finishing out this edition, which has turned out to be far more eventful and interesting than I had thought. But we've been professionals. We've been on our A game here.
Consummate professionals.
Of course, as we always are. Consummating what?
I have no idea.
Superstitions, Matt, this is something that's always fascinated me. Superstitions. And I think it goes back to a really early interest I had with what is called the Matiasma. Have you ever heard of this before?
I have.
And so the Matiasma, of course, where our good friend Tiffany Mack lived for a number of years in Greece, the Greeks would refer to the Matiasma in relation to a cultural tradition that really is held all around the world, and that is of the evil eye. Now, the evil eye, again, it's something that essentially, if it can be something that can be cast upon you and you may not even know that it's happening. It basically means a person looks on at you with a malevolent stare. And hence, you may not know that somebody is staring you, but there are charms and things that literally resemble a little blue eye.
And it's also a killer song by the Canadian psychobilly band, The Matadors.
Oh, okay.
One of my favorite tunes, yeah.
Very interesting. Very interesting. But see, that evil eye tradition isn't just in relation to Greece with the Matiasma. Many cultures have this kind of a belief that if someone looks on you, and I think that often the Matiasma can be associated with blue-eyed people, blonde-haired people. Well, Tiffany's blonde-haired and blue-eyed. I'm kind of a sandy blonde brown. I say I'm brown-haired, okay? But people, in fact, my mother used to say I had molasses hair. And when I was in school at one point, someone asked me when I was, you know, like first grade or something, they said, what color is your hair? And I said, molasses. And they said, your hair is brown, honey. But there are people who argue with me and try and say that I'm blonde. Now, Matt, for all to know, right here, right now, for once and for all, am I a brunette or am I a blonde?
I'd err towards dirty blonde.
Oh, come on.
Come on.
You centrist.
Yeah.
Well, you are a blue-eyed blonde.
Am I?
Are you?
When was... I was blonde when I was a small child.
What color is your hair now?
Dark brown.
No, your hair is lighter colored than mine. Look at it, man.
No, come on.
What color are your eyes?
I was always raised saying green, but in the past several years, hazel seems to be the consensus.
You're just one of those middlemen, aren't you? There's a great podcast you should listen to sometime.
What's it called?
Middle Theory.
Imagine I'll have to check it out, yeah.
It would be worth your time, I think. Okay, so, well, superstitions, you know, again, there are a lot of different reasons, I think, why these things show up in different parts of the world, but you had something also that you were going to add, I think, in relation to these superstitions. I wanted to come back to your thing before we get into some of the various, very unique superstitions as they are celebrated in different parts of the world.
Yeah, I've always been just enthralled with the topic of superstition as well. As you know, one of my early interests lied in the urban legend mythos.
I guess that could be kind of superstition.
And obviously I was looking at the time into the you know what they were predicated on, where the modern legends evolved from.
I
love superstition
that, yeah. And quick, I'll say, when I was a kid, my father had a dictionary of superstitions.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, laying around. I mean, among the other myriad books that he kept.
Yeah. Well, first I wanted to address on the list you have here, there is one that hits close to home and it always cracked me up. It's from Korea, and it's fan death.
Oh.
And it's such a strange idea to me, I guess.
What exactly is fan death?
Fan death.
Is this when somebody goes to Comic-Con and they drink too much and... No,
I don't think so.
Not quite.
It's a different kind of fan death.
Okay.
Especially in South Korea, it's believed that running a fan in a closed room while you're sleeping will, in fact, kill you. And it's
You know what, Diane? It will literally kill you.
That's right. and it's such a prevalent belief that many fans in Korea actually come with auto shutoff timers, apparently. and I've had a friend for years, and he was constantly in and out of the military, and he said one of his first tours in Iraq, when they you know go back and have the rest time and everything, he had a bunk mate initially who was from South Korea, and you know he's like, it's sweltering hot any time of day, and so I'd go and lay down and we'd both be in the bunk, we'd talk for a while, he's like, but the first week I'd wake up in the middle of the night and the fan would be off. And the other guy would be sound asleep. And he's like, I soon found out that he would wait until I would go to sleep and then shut the fan off because he was scared of dying. he's like, I approached him about it later on, and he looks at me and he just goes, fan death. Do you not know about fan death? You can die. And he was terrified of keeping the fan on at night. My buddy actually had to get a different roommate and everything because it became such a problem. But yeah, he refused to go to sleep as long as a fan was on.
Huh. And he sat waiting.
Yeah,
watching.
Apparently he'd fake going to sleep. But I did find a couple interesting superstitions in my research today. These are pretty old ones, but quite riotous nonetheless.
Arcane superstitions are good too.
They are.
Yeah, we like those.
In ancient Britain, women carried acorns in their pockets. This hits close to home, of course, with my last name.
Mr. Oakley.
That's right. To stay looking young. And that's according to Richard Webster in the Encyclopedia of Superstitions.
Now that's kind of funny in itself because Mr. Webster wrote an encyclopedia, but dictionaries are named after him, right?
I think, yeah. Yeah, that's a odd connection.
Yeah, yeah. See, I'm quick like that.
That's right. I wonder if we could build a superstition off of that in and of itself.
Yeah, let's hope not.
But he also goes on to say that the oak tree was once believed to provide longevity and to ward off illness due to its long life, and that's why I'm here.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. The everlasting Oakley.
That's right.
Well, I mean, I'll mention, you know, Sir James George Frazier in The Golden Bough devoted a few chapters to the almost totemic kind of reverence that many people throughout the ages have had for oak trees. I mean, the oak tree has kind of a magical sort of a value to it. So, I mean, and that is something that you find in a lot of mythologies. So when I call you Oak Tree rather than Mr. Oakley, I mean, that's what I mean. I'm right. Referring directly to your magical potency, sir.
And the Reverend Oakley.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the Reverend Oak Tree.
If you've never read that, by the way, the book is called The Golden Bough by Sir James George Frazier. It's really basically an examination of magic and traditions throughout, Occidental, well, other parts of the world too, but well worth the read. Well worth the read. I own two copies. I'll lend you one.
Okay. Well, the other one I found just absolutely cracked me up, and it's about medieval England, and apparently expectant mothers would make a quote-unquote groaning cheese. Have you heard of this?
Of course, of course. Yeah. Everybody knows about the groaning cheese.
I wasn't aware of it.
I'm just kidding. I have no idea what you're talking about. Please enlighten us.
It was a large wheel of cheese that was matured for 9 months as the baby, you know, grew. And when the quote-unquote groaning time came, or the actual birth, the cheese would be shared out among the entire family, and when nothing but the outer rind was left, the baby would be passed through the wheel of cheese on christening day to be blessed with a long and prosperous life.
Is this groaning or growing cheese?
You know, apparently they grew groaning cheese.
So, but it's groaning? Why? Yeah. Why did the cheese groan?
I have no idea.
Let's imagine for a moment, ladies and gentlemen. Honey, you hear that? Your cheese is groaning again.
Yeah, it's about time for the baby to come out.
Yeah, I guess it's about time to bring the baby and pass it through the empty cheese wheel.
Yeah, exactly. Just goes to show that human beings' love of cheese knows no boundaries of time.
No boundaries at all. How weird. Apparently this conversation knows no boundaries of weird.
That's right.
Oh, but in the bunker, there are a few boundaries, aren't there? Which is why Matt and I are sitting here in Speedos doing this show tonight. Just kidding. It's a little too cold for that. I want to go down a list of some of the strangest superstitions from around the world. Some of these, ladies and gentlemen, I'll give you forewarning, may crack you up. In Argentina, bad luck takes a physical manifestation. In fact, it specifically is that of former Argentinian President Carlos Menem. To speak his name aloud is to essentially bring a curse upon yourself. So all within earshot will do the equivalent of knocking on wood, or in this case, they touch either their left breast or their left testicle. That is what they do.
And one of the best things I found about that one is I actually pulled up a picture of Carlos Menem. Have you seen this guy? He looks exactly like a doppelganger for Richard Nixon. It's hilarious.
they were actually one and the same.
Oh, okay. Okay.
They were the same person.
I don't know. According to this superstition, though, I don't feel like there was a good twin and an evil twin. They may have just both been bad.
Yeah, they could have been bad, but they were not a crook. That much we can be certain
That's
of.
That's right.
You know, in Brazil, it's bad luck to let your wallet or purse hit the floor because that means you'll lose money. Well, yeah, especially if you leave it lying there. In China, the number 4 and all iterations thereof, which include 14, 24, and others, these are all incredibly unlucky because the Chinese pronunciation of the number is nearly identical to that of the Chinese pronunciation of the word death. So coupled with the Western beliefs about 13 and 23, it makes navigating high rises in China uniquely confusing. In Denmark, broken dishes are collected and saved year-round to be thrown at the houses of friends and family on New Year's Eve. The bigger the pile of porcelain, the more good fortune that the recipients will have in the new year.
That sounds like a blast.
Yeah, or a break. In Egypt, it's viewed as frightfully bad luck if you open and close a pair of scissors but fail to cut anything. Yeah, and even worse if you leave them open while leaving them lying around. But Egyptians also believe that scissors under a pillow can cure a person of their nightmares. Now, why would that be? You cut them out of your mind?
Then you lobotomize yourself from sleeping on top of them.
Yeah, or you cut your earlobe from, you know, rolling around in your sleep and accidentally stabbing yourself with a pair of scissors under you. That's about as bad an idea as the old timers, you know, putting a gun under their pillow.
Yeah, man.
For safekeeping.
That's right.
Because that's just a really safe place to put a gun, right? Yeah, like right underneath your head while you sleep. No, thank you. In France, it's good luck to step in dog poop with your left foot, but bad luck to step in it with your right foot.
That's what I've been doing wrong all these years.
Yeah, and while no one seems to know the origin of this belief, it may explain the abundance of canine landmines scattered throughout parts of Brittany. For all of you people who are going out there hunting the standing stones of Brittany, yeah, now you know. A foul breeze is blowing, and it has nothing to do with birds. In Greece, we already know, of course, that they have their matiasma, but they also have this unique kind of version of the idea of a jinx. For instance, I was at a store today, and I was purchasing Kleenex, okay, tissues. And I went up to the woman at the counter and everything, and the minute I said, "Hi, how are you?" she said the same thing. And then, "Good, how are you?" And we just started laughing because we were saying the exact same thing to each other as I was going through the checkout. But I almost wanted to say, "Jinx, you got to buy me a cola."
Do it now.
Do it now, woman. Buy me a cola. Yeah, because that's the rules of the jinx, right? The first one who's, you know, when they actually proclaim it was a jinx. Jinx. So you hear about that, where two people say the same thing. Well, if they say the same thing at the same time, in Greece, they must instead utter piase kokino, which means touch red. When you touch the color red anywhere around you to avoid the otherwise inevitable fight that is going to occur, because if you have jinxed in Greece, apparently it's a Mortal Kombat situation, fight to the death.
Finish him.
Liu Kang.
Yeah. They say, of course, if this happens around Easter, it's good because usually there are a lot of red Easter eggs lying around. In India, they have very specific rules about grooming. For instance, you must not trim your nails on Tuesday or Saturday, or at night, ever. Nor can you cut or wash your hair on Thursday or Saturday. There's some controversy over the origin of this practice, but it's generally believed that trimming nails at night leads to sweeping.
I wonder if that, what's the guy in India, what is his name?
Ravi Shankar.
That's it.
Oh, really?
No.
Is that right?
Oh, no, it's not.
Darn, you really got me excited there for a second.
No, it is, Sridhar. Sridhar Chilal, mm-hmm. And he's got the world's longest nails. I wonder if that's where he got that kind of idea.
That would be interesting if a superstition had inspired him not to cut his nails.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's generally believed that trimming nails at night leads to sweeping, they say, but there are other things, too, that may have to do with this, including, you know, the planet Saturn, which is, of course, revered among the ancient Hindus. In Haiti, life's treacherous for a mom, and here's why, because if you walk with only one shoe on and you sweep the floor at night, once again, this whole thing about sweeping the floor at night, they say if you move around on your knees or if you eat the tops of watermelons and or grapefruits, then you may have already brought about the untimely death of your mother if you've done any of those things. Now, Japan's interesting because in Japan, you know, young children are warned to hide their stomachs during thunderstorms. But and this is especially before they go to sleep. And the reason why, as they say, is it is believed that if you are not careful, Raijin, the god of thunder, or Raiden, you know, again, to make our Mortal Kombat. Boy, what's up with the Mortal Kombat references tonight?
Finish him. Liu Kang. Johnny Cage.
Yeah. So Raiden will come and steal and eat your belly button during a storm if you don't hide your tummy. It's kind of strange. But there's another weird ghost story associated with Japan. And I don't know, I'm kind of scared, Matt. The very utterance of ghost story, I worry now that if I tell another ghost story that we're going to go off the air again.
Yeah, send us spiraling into darkness once again.
Spiraling into darkness, or even worse.
Two drunken Englishmen are accidentally sucked into an ever-changing vortex of past and future ages. Doug Hatton and Tony Kirby, without a change of clothes in several months, now tumble helplessly towards an exciting new adventure along the infinite corridors of time.
This is the best thing in the world. If you've never seen this, okay? This is a comedy sketch show that featured a number of different actors back in the day. This probably would have been in the 1990s. But Alexei Sale and Peter Capaldi, who plays the current Doctor, they were two of the characters on this. And the recurring skit that they would be featured on is called Drunk in Time.
Oh, that sounds like a blind.
This is the Drunk in Time theme.
In time.
That's our new soundbite right there.
Drunk in time.
Drunk in,
I like it.
Yeah, drunk in time. So that could happen to us if we tell ghost stories in the studio. See, an all-new superstition is born. If we tell ghost stories in the studio, we will end up drunk in time. I think this is actually coming to fruition. This is kind of scary.
Like inside of time or in due time?
Throughout time, throughout
time.
Periods in history. In Lithuania, whistling indoors is forbidden. So is smoking, Matt. Since it's believed that doing so will summon wee devils that will terrorize you. In Malaysia, sitting on a pillow will cause your butt and backside to become covered in boils, blisters, and sores, because in reality, this probably stems from the fact that no one likes to sleep on a butt pillow.
That's right. Get that pink eye.
Yeah, exactly. In Nigeria, if a man is hit with a broom, he will become impotent. And or his genitals will disappear.
That's horrifying.
Yes. Some believe that this can be countered by hitting the offender back with a broom, but no fewer than 7 times.
I love how specific some of these are.
Yeah, not 6, not 8, but 7 times. Because if you are struck with a broom and you don't strike back, your genitals may disappear. That's terrible. Wow. Okay. Glad I don't live in Nigeria, I guess. In Oman, the best practice for cleansing a new car is blasting the Quran on audiobook through the sound system for a week or two. This is said to also protect the car and owner from the evil eye of envy, one of the many iterations, I guess, of the Matiasma. In the Philippines, there are what are known as, of course, sun showers. Now, we've talked about this some. And it's believed that if a sun shower occurs, then a wedding has taken place not between foxes, but between demon horses. Wow. In Qatar, they have all but done away with superstitions, instead teaching students that such beliefs are forbidden. However, it was once believed that spiders had the power to control and extinguish house fires. Spiders had the ability to control and extinguish house fires.
Now I just see it, get an image of like a, you know, one of those like stick figure spiders, like, stand back.
I got this. Well, good for them, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
In you know, having done away with superstitions, by the way, is what I was saying. In Rwanda, women are taught from an early age to avoid the meat of goats, as eating it will cause them to grow beards.
Of course. I thought that was common knowledge.
If you eat the meat of a goat, you will grow a beard. That's really strange. In Sweden, you might see pedestrians swerving and taking unusual circuitous routes while walking to work or around town. And that's because the manhole covers around the country are marked with a K, which is the Swedish word for fresh water and coincidentally also for love, or the letter A, which is the Swedish word for sewage and broken love. So some locals believe that the romantic fortune and fate can be determined by the amount of K and A covers that they pass over, and they will plan their paths accordingly. If the wrong kind of manhole cover is passed over, well, bad luck can be countered by 3 unsolicited pats on the back. Matt, come here. 3 completely unsolicited pats on the back will cure you of all your ails.
That's good to know.
In Turkey, it's bad to chew gum at night because the Turkish believe that after dark, the gum becomes the flesh of dead people.
Good Lord.
Kind of horrible.
Yeah.
Here in the United States, particularly around the state of Vermont, many 19th century farmhouses were built with slanted witch windows. This due to the commonly held belief that witches could not fly their brooms into a tilted opening.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of pictures of the witch windows. It's really kind of cool architecture, but didn't realize until recently it came from that superstition.
Which is why those witches flew all the way around the world and started swatting men with their brooms.
Right.
Yes, to make their manhood disappear. In Vietnam, many foods are avoided by students hoping to do well in school or on exams. Bananas, for example, are avoided by students because they are slippery. And the Vietnamese word for slip sounds exactly the same as the Vietnamese word for fail. There you go. Now you know. In Wales, making a hat out of hazel sticks and leaves and wearing it can grant you one wish. But see, that's not a superstition. That's true.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm going
to get over there.
Well, we're going to go over there. We're going to make a hat of hazel sticks and leaves. So we can have our one wish. But if we, yeah, do we each get a wish? That's my question. In Yemen, a pregnant woman can determine the gender of her unborn baby by throwing a dead snake up in the air. If the snake lands on its back, the baby will be a girl. If it lands upright, the baby will become a corporeal revenant. Ah, it's a boy.
Okay.
And in Zimbabwe, belief in black magic runs rampant. For example, a husband might have a spell cast on his wife to prevent her from committing adultery. Should extramarital hanky-panky take place nonetheless, the couple will be bound and incapable of separation. This is known colloquially as durawalling, after a brand name of concrete that they sell in Zimbabwe, and is believed to so prevalently, or is so prevalently believed, that it actually acts as a strong deterrent against such extramarital affairs. After all, Matt, you don't want to end up being concreted into a wall. Durawalling. Who'd have thunk it? Well, so those are some of these superstitions. Very, very weird stuff. But, you know, I'll kind of say this as we're wrapping things up here. I wonder sometimes if the plausible basis for belief in superstition doesn't come from something else. You know, for example, one thing I'm thinking about is OCD. You think about all the great artists like Freddie Mercury, Andy Kaufman, and people who intentionally went untreated for their obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah, Warren Zevon was one of them, too.
Was he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, a lot of these people, they'll go home at night. They may not do it out in public. I'm OCD. I mean, I'm like this. I'll do things in private that would probably make no sense to anybody. You know, collecting my pens and, you know, putting my socks together in a certain way when I'm doing the laundry and things. But I remember Andy Kaufman talking about coming home, checking the lock on his front door. He had seven locks, and he'd check it seven times. He'd look under the bed three times or something before he went to bed.
That was Zevon's. He said he would, every day, he'd go out to the mailbox. And apparently, Billy Bob Thornton has a similar affliction, and they lived right near each other. And Zevon apparently every morning would go out to the mailbox and open it and close it seven times before he'd take the mail out. And he said the way they met is Billy Bob Thornton walked out to get his mail at the same time, too, and just looked at him and goes, "You too, huh?"
You know, that's what's funny, though, is that I wonder sometimes if this could be the practical basis. Now, there's nothing practical about doing something like that, but people have these little quirks, these little, you know, these, they may not even think about it, but these little daily rituals. Now, I refer to like drinking coffee in the morning as a ritual, but I'm talking about somebody who literally engages in some sort of a nonsensical act because doing so grants some sort of, you know, whether mental or otherwise, in their belief, some kind of protection. Or at very least, it's some sort of gratification that only they can understand, but which nonetheless has no practical benefit. And I can't help but, you know, something that stems from a condition like OCD over the years, could that have maybe contributed to certain beliefs and superstitions? And furthermore, could this be something that's so innately wound around humanity in different parts of the world that this also could explain the consistency between beliefs in different parts of the world among different cultures, like, for instance, the evil eye? Or like sun showers and animal weddings and other kind of things that are very similar.
It's funny. That's a really interesting area of discourse to get into because, like I said earlier, me going into the ideas behind urban legends, that's something that's fairly easily traceable and usually has a social phenomena aspect. But if these type of superstitions have kind of a OCD aspect that's specific to one person, it just kind of grows and grows and grows. It makes their origins so much harder to determine.
Well, I think so too. And I think also that to understand the multi-leveled weirdness of, for instance, the ancient world, we have to be able to look back in time and think about the things that were meaningful to people and maybe the reasons why those things were meaningful. They may make no sense to us today. They may even seem nonsensical. And therefore, they seem mysterious. But if we apply logic to understanding the ways that strange beliefs take shape and have done so over time, we may begin to understand aspects of not only the ancient world, but even just riddles of space-time in an all-new way. Maybe. You never know. Be open-minded. Matthew, as always, thank you for joining me here in the studio.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters, including Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Caleb Hanks, Jeremy London, Rayson Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, and yours truly, I remain your doctor here in the dark heart of the hollow earth. We'll catch you next time. And as always, my friends, stay strange out there.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.